This is the poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Shara McCollum is here, and she makes history better by poetry and imagines history better than history could imagine itself. Shara, what have you done? What is this book about?
Well, the book is an alternate account of history. And first of all, Grace, it's so wonderful to see you again. Thank you for having me back on the program. And it is a history predicated on a thread from the life of the 18th century Scottish poet Robert Burns. The fact is that this great poet of the Romantic era and of the product of the Enlightenment almost went to Jamaica to work on a slave plantation, something I discovered when I was first visiting London, Scotland. I was living in London at the time in 2015. And this really sparked for me a question that instigated the entirety of this book, which is what would have happened had he gone?
Mm.
What saved him from going to be basically an overseer on a plantation is that his first book of poems sold out incredibly well. So, you know, changing that one detail, making him have the fate that most poets actually enjoy in their life, which is not to be famous, it would have put him on one of those ships he had booked passage on. So
it's based on possibility.
Absolutely.
And the magic of it is that poetry uplifts history. Say a bit about how powerful poetry can illuminate history.
Well, in this particular instance, you know, the history of slavery, of miscegenation, passing, all of which this book is dealing with, colonization and its lingering effects, the historical archives are pretty slim. From the perspective of those who were colonized, enslaved Africans, and the descendants of enslaved Africans. So in this sense, history has all these gaps and silences, Grace, and poetry, which I always hear is speaking into silence, I think is particularly suited for intervening in that historical record and
that is beautiful.
Hear what's absent.
I love what you just said, how poetry fills in those spaces and intervenes.
Yeah.
That really was a really unexpected answer. I'm so happy you're here. What's the title of the book?
No Ruined Stone.
And why that title?
There's a long story, but I'll give you the short answer. There's a poem by the 20th century Scottish poet Hugh MacDiarmid, and in it is a phrase I'm borrowing. There are plenty of ruined buildings in this world, but no ruined stones. And so the poem is a beautiful long poem, and I excerpted just that phrase and made the stone singular as opposed to plural.
Because it says so much about permanence, mm-hmm. and what is powerful. Give us one poem out of the book, and then we will penetrate your story after that.
Sure. So the opening and the closing poem, Grace, are both in my voice as the poet, and they're both bearing the title of the collection. So I think I'll start with the opening. It's addressed to Burns. So the you I'm speaking with in the poem or to is Burns. And it's also engaging with a portrait of that same poet, Hugh MacDiarmid, that I saw by the Scottish visual artist, Callum Colvin. Mm. So it's a ekphrasis, it's a dramatic monologue, it's addressed to Burns. No ruined stone. You saturate the sight of those who come after, poets and painters alike. Your words invade my mind's listening, manacle my tongue when I try to speak. On all I backward cast my eye and fear and cannot see. Who would I have been to you? What stone? In the ruined house of the past, in this world, I am unloosed, belonging to no country, no tribe, no clan, not African, not Scotland. And you, voice that stalks my waking and dreaming, you, more myth than man, cannot unmake history. So why am I here resurrecting you to speak. When your silence gulfs centuries, why do I find myself on your doorstep knocking when I know the dead will never answer?
And that is a great taste of your lyricism, and for which this book is so well praised. We'll start at the beginning. Who is Robert Burns?
So many people know Burns. And the thing I've been doing as I've been reading from this book is actually just singing, "Should old acquaintance be forgot?" Right? So once you start that opening chord, everyone's like, oh, I do know Burns, right? So he was a singer, a songwriter. I love his poems very much. Ode to a Mouse being my favorite, probably, of all of his work, and from which we get the phrase, the best laid schemes of mice and men.
Mm.
So here's this, you know, man born over 250 years ago, and whose work we continue to have, in the way sometimes poems work, imbricated into our language. Even if we don't know its origins or its source, it enriches our perspective in the world. I personally came to Burns as an undergraduate who loved British romantic poetry. I've spoken about this many times. I know I'm a mixed race Black woman, look white, have Venezuelan, Jamaican ancestry. So why would I have connected with these men, ostensibly, you know, with whom I have little in common? I think it's the way that poetry speaks to us across great distances of time and experience. The intimacy of a poem is what I connected with in Burns, even as a young girl.
And you do touch upon your own origins and sources. Born in Jamaica, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jamaican father, Venezuelan mother. You then would naturally be interested in Jamaica and Scotland.
Sure.
Absolutely. I can see that. And it has a lot of personal source too. So who are the other characters in the book?
So Burns is the speaker in the first half of the book, predominantly. He goes to the real plantation he would have worked on in this imagined alternate account of history. And that plantation is Springbank. The owner, the master, so-called, of the plantation, Charles Douglas, real figure from history who owned the plantation Burns was actually contracted to go and work on. And Burns is principally the character who speaks. His brother Gilbert, he is often speaking to, or maybe at some point you wonder if he's just speaking to himself in some of these poems that I have in his voice.
Oh, well, we're going to hear something of this. Oh, continue. There are three more characters.
There are. So an enslaved African woman on that plantation, Nancy, born in Africa and abducted and transported across the Atlantic by the Middle Passage. Burns meets her, has a multi-year relationship with her. They bear a child. That child is raped by the master of the plantation. And out of that comes the birth of the speaker of the second half of the book, Isabella.
Right.
Isabella, mixed race, Black woman who looks white and ends up passing for white. And the complexity of that narrative is exposed in the different speakers that I have in this collection, principally Burns and Isabella. But, you know, that's the bones of it, Grace.
It is a dramatic piece of literature, for sure. It's dramatic literature as well as a book of poems, and fascinating because of the voices. Give us a poem and let us tell everyone who you are.
Sure.
Sharon McCollum is the author of 6 books of poetry, and they've been published in the United States and in the UK. No Ruined Stone is the present book. Mad Woman came out in 2017. The Face of Water was her new and selected in 2011. Then there was This Strange Land that same year, Song of Thieves prior to that, and The Water Between Us. And she is a full press, I think, a professor right now at Penn State, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've watched you in so many colleges and universities, and now she is the Sparks Professor of English, the Edwin Eric Sparks Chair at Penn State. Mm-hmm. Let's have a poem.
Sure. So I think I'll read a poem in Burns' voice, and this is at the end of his time. The whole time he's in Jamaica, what you need to know is he's still writing his poems and songs and sending them back to Scotland. The difference is he's utterly not received as the famous bard in his lifetime in this book. But he continues to persist as an artist. His daughter is born into slavery. He's unable to free her. And he dies 10 years into his stay in Jamaica, feeling really utterly a failure as a man, a human being, as a poet, and struggling against that, as well as the mental illness and poor physical health he suffered in his real life, I have play out in this alternate space. So that's all you need to know to hear this. This is Burns speaking toward the end of his life. Crumbo jingle. Days fold into days, and I hold fast to snatches of heart songs learned before the hearth. When a child, I listened as my mother sang. I carried those airs across the sea. I bear them now as more and more I morph into another, a spirit absented from its host. Evenings, I return to this room to shape memory to music, whilst night stretches without end, taunting me to confront the rift in myself. The crumbo jingle, the poems I send for safekeeping, these songs I offer to the work of preservation. So faithfully, could they salvage my life? Could they recover our voices, restore our better selves? They are all I have, and all that stays bedlam from overtaking me. In time, every man becomes the nightmare from which he cannot wake, as the clock strikes out the hour upon the hour.
Imagine how you enter that psychosis and what it takes to create that character. When did the grand obsession begin? We're always interested in knowing how long it takes to write a book like this. What I know you said as a graduate student you were interested, but what was the day you said, I have got to bring this to life?
So it was actually in my undergraduate years. So I started university at 17, turning 18. So in many ways, I think as a writer, we carry the stories in us without sometimes knowing when the set of circumstances will come together. In graduate school, I wrote one of my comprehensive exams for my PhD was on the tracing the tragic mulatta, that character in African-American literature.
Has it been published?
No.
That's got to be published.
No, it doesn't need to be. It was just a comprehensive exam, truly. But I think about those threads of learning, you know, that I thought would not inform the poetry necessarily directly. And I think it's really when I was met with that question, you know, and I thought about it's kind of like the all those forces that come together in a moment. All my life, obviously, I carry the surname McCallum. It's my father's. And people have often asked me, Grace, if I'm Scottish. And I have to say to them, my name is patrilineal and my father's father was a Black Jamaican. So if I'm Scottish, not perhaps in the way you're imagining right now. And so I think like all of those kinds of threads of experience that we have as readers, as humans, they were what led to this obsession. The book took 3 years from that question, what would have happened had he gone, for me to write the poems. And in that interim, I was finishing a previous collection, Mad Woman. I was moving house. I was, you know, teaching, doing other things, but I kept coming back to it through research. I've always loved research. I visited the archives. I made many trips to Scotland, kept turning over in my head, how am I going to do this? How will I meet this question with poetry? It's really a novelist's question. What would have happened had he gone, right? And so I, as a poet, asked poetry to answer the question of a novel in these lyric, dramatic poems, but that over the course of the book have that kind of novelistic arc.
I'm glad you mentioned that because it is at the heart of it. What if?
Yeah.
What if? And that is a novelist in you. Let us have two poems from No Ruined Stone. Sharon McCallum is here with her great, vast interest and knowledge and beauty.
Thank you, Grace. I will read a poem in Isabella's voice. And as I mentioned, the name of this plantation, Springbank, that's where Isabella was born and spent almost the first decade of her life.
Again, and remind us who she is.
She is the granddaughter of Robert Burns. And she, you will hear in this poem how she escapes. Her father is Douglas, the master of the plantation who rapes her mother. And her mother dies in childbirth. And Isabella is raised by her grandmother, Nancy Burns, paramour, the enslaved African with whom he has a relationship.
Did he actually marry Nancy?
No, I mean, there's not a great word. And that's one of the things that I try hard to talk about and unpack in this book is levels of power relationships. You know, from Burns' perspective in the first half of the book, he thinks he loves Nancy. In the second half of the book, Isabella is constantly asking, her grandmother has died. Isabella's in Scotland. It's 1825. Slavery is ongoing. And she has come of age and is asking, what does that kind of love mean? What in the context of slavery could that have possibly meant for her grandmother?
What a question.
So I'll read a poem maybe that, now that we've spoken about it, I'm thinking I'll change my mind. And I'll read a poem that speaks to Burns, but Isabella's frustration with her inheritance and the fact that she cannot acknowledge her grandfather, who, by the way, when he dies, he becomes the famous bard. Here she's in Scotland. He's having this heyday. His work is having a heyday in his death. And she can't acknowledge that because that would mean she'd no longer be passing for white.
And that's at the end of the story.
That's in the second half of the book. Yeah. I'm dealing with this. She's also married to a white Scotsman who doesn't know the truth of her ancestry. So for Isabella, there's huge danger involved with, you ask that, you know, question, why would somebody pass? It's to escape slavery. It's to have the opportunity to live the life of a white woman, which is full of more privilege than she would have enjoyed, obviously, as a Black woman born into slavery. So there's a kind of existential angst for Isabella, but there's also the emotional question of, who are you betraying doing this?
Yes. And the secrets that must be held.
The secrets and the danger. I mean, all of that's in this second half of the book.
So, fabulous.
And she's indebted to her grandmother, who's the person she loves maybe best in this world.
Well, give us one or two poems, and we are now on your track. We've got you.
Inheritance. My grandmother taught me to fear the sea. She crossed first as a girl on that passage. Her mother's voice lost, her language lost, each lullaby swallowed by the sea's cavernous din, the roiling waves she'd meet again and again in dreams, moaning, thrashing, waking years later, urging me each time, remember, with every surface, what lies beneath. In journeying here, what choice was I given but to morph, shape-shifting to what she feared, in learning to be more of you, more like you, mimicking your speech, your dress, lacing myself invisibly into your world, a shadow passing seamlessly through your cosseted rooms, walking dusk-lit streets, no one I see knowing her name, but yours everywhere. Everywhere. How have I not betrayed her? In death, my life, erasing and erasing her.
Powerful. Let's have another.
I'm going to read the one poem in which Nancy speaks in this book. And it's at the moment where her granddaughter, Isabella, has really come to a crisis moment about how can she continue to keep up this facade? And she comes and she speaks to her in dream. Her grandmother, the Jamaican word Duppy here is in the title. It means ghost. At the hour of Duppy and dream, Miss Nancy speaks. You think what lies before you asks more than you can bear. But I am with you now, as I was when you came into this world, your one eye forever looking forward, your other forever looking back. From the netherworld, you were flung into this one, squalling, full of that scent we could not wash away. Your mother's breath extinguished as you gulped your first, the call swaddling your face till we lifted it, unveiling, beholding the unasked for, girl child cast down in a place of stone, of men who cannot see to see, do not hear what needs listening, men who have riven borders and nations, and you in whom the rift has opened. Hear me, for I was there in the beginning, witness as you entered, as you came dusking, tearing all asunder, rending the fabric they call truth.
I don't know how you, what kind of zone you were in to get there in those poems. And as I read, I thought not only the story is compelling, like a story with characters and situations and a plot, but the different ways that you do it. You have lyricism, you have narrative, you have direct address, you have a very rich way of putting parallel stanzas on the same page. And I'm wondering how the form informed the content. How did the content make the form? How did you decide how it was going to be on the page? What inside of you, what rhythm happened to make them so varied and so penetrating?
You know, I think it's important to say this is my sixth book. So I think in a lot of ways, I'm really interested in form for a long time now. And I think I'd never had a question like the one that occurred to me as a writer. So I really had to use all of the resources of poetry and all of those in me to answer and match it. And so that's on some level the answer. I don't know in the writing of the poems, it's not utterly conscious. But I think as writers, everything we've read, everything we've written, we're imbibing it. We're using those techniques, if you will, or elements of craft that they feel to us in the moment like intuition because we have forgotten that we learned them.
But you know, there's something about the variations that keep the book moving. I mean, it's a device too. Technically, it is a very smart thing because you have motion all through the book from your various forms.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think that comes out of the work of arrangement, revision, the re-seeing that you do. But when you were asking the question of what prompts you to write in the form, honestly, I don't have a great answer for that. These are not, I'm going to sit down now and write this poem in this column. It's how I heard it. And so the form of that poem is a way for me to structure all of those very weighted silences when I heard Isabella speaking, all those sujuras that are occurring on the page. They're like a score that I'm trying to get all of that in the work. And so I'm feeling my way through the forms a lot of times. The voices that I hear, and I don't mean this to sound esoteric, but they're voices I hear speaking. And so I follow them and I write down what they're saying.
Amen, sister. I'm right with you there. But I can't help but think that at some point you sat down and one day you felt more pointillistic than another day.
Maybe it had to do
with your own delicacy or your own strength on that particular day. And how you occupied the men's voices, I thought was awfully interesting.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I found Isabella and Nancy far easier. I have said many times, yes, I'm aware Isabella bears a striking resemblance to Shara. I'm not unaware of that. Again, the differences for her living in the 19th century cannot be overstated.
I think she's totally I think she's quite representative of her time.
Right, right. Completely. So there's a merging of it at points. There's a way in which I show that there's an unmasking, you know, there are ways in which her experience and mine overlap. But clearly I want her to be rooted in that narrative moment of history, which is the history of slavery and colonization.
Yeah, so talk about colonization.
By that, you know.
Yeah, say more about colonization, because there are so many messages we get through the poetry that are not in your face. They're just extremely subtle and graceful. But what are some of the messages that we get about colonialism? Naturally, we know that slavery, what it was like in Jamaica. But do tell us what you think is strong.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do and I think we don't. You know, I think that the thing is that the narratives that we have are kind of one-dimensional. So in order to reenact this history, I had to live inside of it. And I had to therefore, and I'll speak to Isabella in a moment, but the history of the slave master and having to re-inhabit that voice for that one monologue, that was incredibly difficult for me to try to find a way to ventriloquize Douglas. And so I think, yes, it's true. We do. People say, oh, I've heard about slavery. I know about slavery or colonization. Why are you still writing about this? And I'm thinking, there's a dearth of material, actually, from this perspective. There are not that many books of, name me a book of poetry that deals with the 19th century figure of the mulatto or mulatta in poetry moving from Jamaica to Scotland. Name it for me.
Good point.
And so I tire a little bit sometimes, and I'm not saying you're asking this, but of that presumption that we're done with this subject. What I knew is that I'm not done with this subject. you know, and that this was a vexation for me. So I don't know that I have a message, but I want people to sit inside of this moment that is everything we continue to live with today. So if there's a message for me, it's that the things that are set in motion in the 18th century, in the 21st century, we're still dealing with now. Right? The unfinished project of the Enlightenment. I've said before, this book is my 30-year vexation with that unfinished project. It is about my recognition that the work of these men that I love, the work that I love, are written by people who would not have seen me. Or if they had, would have not seen me in a way I would like to be seen. Right? And that's just those kinds of issues that we continue to deal with in the modern world, capitalism, as it's writ now, where it is all over the globe in ways that dehumanize. How is the transatlantic slave trade not the beginning of that incredible erasure of humans for profit? The notion that people, you know, and that's one of the ways I got to Douglas's voice, was thinking about why would somebody believe what Douglas believes? What would allow you to believe that?
That is the point that I hope to make, is that it was performed in a way unlike history, unlike statistics, that when you say you get inside the subject, you're talking about the souls of the people that were at the very beginning of the ideas. And that is why poetry is the only way we can get there. And
well,
I think
statistics
overwhelm contribution.
You know, statistics, we tune out. We don't understand them. We have, I mean, I have friends who teach stats and maths, and they say it's true. You know, as humans, we have really poor comprehension of stats.
But
it's just known. But take one person, you know, it's like make it someone's mother, make it someone's child. And then all of a sudden, the engagement with the cost, the enduring cost of slavery and colonization for those of us who have this experience that we carry in our bodies, in our genes, in our histories, that's what I wanted people to sit with and live with me.
And you did, Sharon McCollum. Yeah. I want to tell you, you did that. You created people who will live longer than we will, and who have, good and bad, gave their vibrations on the page. And you have told us how it feels, not only what happened. And that is the point I want to make. May we have a final poem?
Of course. I think I will close with the poem that is when I come back and speak in my voice at the end. And it is a poem I wrote on the anniversary of my own grandmother's death when I was in Scotland in May in 2018. And it is also for all of my ancestors. No ruined stone. When the dead return, they will come to you in dream, and in waking will be the bird knocking, knocking against glass, seeking a way in, will masquerade as the wind, its voice made audible by the tongues of leaves, greedily lapping as the waves' self-made fugue is a turning and returning. The dead will not then nor ever again desert you. Their unrest will be the coat cloaking you. The farther you journey from them, the more distance will maw in you. Time and place gulching when the dead return to demand accounting. Wanting and wanting and wanting everything you have to give, and nothing will quench or unhunger them as they take all you make as offering, then tell you to begin again.
The voice of Shara McCowan from No Ruined Stone. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding was provided by the Snippet Fund, by Natalie Canivore, and by Sandy Jackson Cohen. I am Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.